from 89.3 KPCC. This is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Happy New Year's Eve. Thanks for spending today, or at least part of your day, with us. Coming up, there's going to be some Ducks playing in the Rose Bowl tomorrow. We're going to get some insight into how the University of Oregon got its mascot. And yeah, there is a Southern California connection. Plus, we're also going to hear from the Moreno Valley Marching Band, who'll be playing in the Rose Parade. That's coming up in about 40 minutes, so stay tuned. First, though, we're going to look ahead a little bit to 2020. Some new state laws are shining a spotlight on California's colleges and universities. And here to give us all the details is KPCC's higher education reporter, Adolfo Guzman López. Welcome.
Thanks a lot. Happy New Year's Eve. We made it.
I know, we did. We're right there on the cusp. Now, a few months ago, Governor Gavin Newsom signed the Fair Pay to Play law. Did it on LeBron James's HBO show, by the way. Big deal. It'll change college sports in California and very likely the rest of the country. Adolfo, what were the details?
Well, this law is breaking all the previous amateur rules for college athletes. College athletes can now receive payment for endorsements. They can be represented by agents, which, it couldn't happen before. The college athletes will be able to get money to promote products to their social media followers, for example, and get paid to give lessons, get paid by video game makers, for example. It's a result of something that's been obvious for many years, which is that college sports is a multi-billion dollar industry. You've got ticket sales, you've got TV rights, but those producing the product, the college athletes, have gotten nothing.
Yeah, someone could have a jersey, and no, they get nothing of that jersey, even though it's clearly them. Now, so when are these endorsements going to start?
They're going to start in 2023, but a lot of details have to be sorted out before then. The NCAA, that's the agency that makes all the rules for college sports, was initially opposed to the law. And after it passed, leadership there said that it's going to work, it's not going to oppose the law anymore, that the regional leaders are going to be able to work out the details. And that's going to happen at the National Convention for the NCAA, which takes place the third week of January. Guess where?
Where?
Here in Anaheim.
Right here.
California.
Wow. All right. Now, the law's a law, but any opposition to it since its passing?
None like there was before the law passed. Before it passed, college athletic directors, the NCAA, they were opposed to it, and they were worried about how this was going to affect other sports on the campuses. You're not hearing any of that opposition now. I talked to the athletic director at Cal State Long Beach. He told me that he's embracing the change, there's one thing he's still worried about, though. He's still worried about how sports agents are going to be approaching college athletes. So he'd like to see some kind of regulation there.
All right. So let's talk about some of the other state laws that will affect California colleges and universities. The college admission scandal was born in California. And really, its most egregious alleged fraud took place right down the street, USC. So what's Sacramento doing about it?
Well, state legislators, first of all, they did not pass any tougher penalties or regulation of the college advisor industry. But they did pass a law that requires public and private colleges to reveal admissions backdoors, as they're calling them. These are legal. So starting this year, campuses will have to report how many students they're admitting who didn't qualify, but who were admitted because of a relationship to a donor, alumnus, also through athletics. Legislators say that it's important for the public to know how often universities sidestep their own admissions policies to benefit the wealthy.
All right. Now, California has the largest population of undocumented college students in the nation. The state passed laws to help these students pay for college. What's new in 2020 for these students?
Well, there's a new law that requires California community colleges and Cal States to have a center for students who are undocumented. And at these centers, students can get counseling of different kinds, academic or personal counseling. They can also get legal advice. Campuses must also appoint a person to coordinate services for students who are undocumented. Now, most Cal State campuses already have these centers, but most community colleges do not. And the community colleges are where most students who are undocumented attend. So this is likely to help provide a lot of help for these students.
All right. One more thing as we head toward the March primary in California. Educators have been talking about a crisis in civic participation and low voting rates among college-age students, and legislators are enlisting colleges to help. How are they doing that?
Well, college students in California are going to be seeing a lot of email reminders from their college campuses on election days, on where to register to vote, on early voting information. And they're going to be seeing voting events on campus. The new law requires community colleges and Cal State campuses to appoint a civic and voter empowerment coordinator on the campus to plan at least 3 yearly outreach events. The author of the new law says it's urgent to turn around these low rates of youth voting. so that we can have a healthy democracy.
That's Adolfo Guzman Lopez, KPCC's higher ed reporter. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, also starting on January 1st, LA's new permit program for street vendors begins. But is the city ready to manage tens of thousands of folks hawking everything from bacon-wrapped hot dogs to T-shirts? Well, KPCC's Eric Galindo set out to get some answers.
Walter Soto is making flour tortilla tacos in a large street cart stationed in a Boyle Heights alley. He began his microbusiness 4 years ago.
No, tengo todo en regla.
Soto tells me everything he does is by the book. He points proudly at his LA County health permit. He's also got his California seller's permit and his LA business license. On this Taco Tuesday, he's nearly sold out of his Sonora-inspired tacos and is blissfully unaware that very soon, he'll be required by the city to buy a new street vendor permit. He wonders, does this apply to him? It does. Starting January 1st, every LA street vendor of tacos, pupusas, hot chicken sandwiches, even clothes, or anything really, will have to buy a permit or eventually face fines. This new rule that city leaders voted in a year ago undoes nearly 100 years of bans on street vending. And this is happening in the U.S. city most known for street food.
The street vending permit system is not ready.
That's Rudy Espinoza. He's one of the leading voices in the campaign to legalize street vendors. I talked with him a few weeks before the looming deadline at his Boyle Heights nonprofit, Inclusive Action for the City. He's just returned from a meeting at City Hall. Espinoza was exasperated.
If you and I go out on the street right now and talk to a street vendor and say, hey, do you know where to get your permit? In January 1st, 2020, I bet you they will not know because neither of us know.
I took Espinoza up on his challenge and hit up LA's famed street merchant hotspots to see what the vendors know. What I found were bits of conflicting information that trickled out like melted ice out of a frutero's cart. Marisela Velasquez has been selling ropa para niños y mujeres, women's and kids' clothing, for 6 years on a sidewalk near Central and 42nd, where dozens of vendors pop up each day. Maricela says she has no idea what the permit will cost, just that it's expensive. And she says there's a rumor they can get permits at City Hall, which, by the way, is wrong. The permits are actually being handled by the Bureau of Street Services, known as Streets LA, in the downtown Fashion District, where vendors can go apply for permits starting January 2nd. But the little information Velasquez knows is more than any other vendor I talked with in Boyle Heights, East LA, or the Piñata District. I asked LA officials how they plan to enforce the new rules when relatively few street vendors even know how they'll get a permit.
Hello?
Can you hear us?
With just days to go before the January 1st deadline, I got a return phone call from the head of Streets LA, Adele Hashkalil. The city was just announcing a new website with information for vendors and a six-month grace period.
The enrollment period of 6 months is to allow folks to take the time to work with them so that nobody will get cited if they don't have a permit.
He says the information bottleneck was a result of last-minute changes in city council. The final details weren't approved until November. He says the rollout grace period was the plan all along. I call Rudy Espinoza, who says this is all news to him.
Is that the first time you're seeing like that amount of detail?
Yes.
But even with 6 months, there's still lots to do. The info website for vendors just went up, and how some vendors will afford permits is still a question. Maricela Velasquez calls the news good and bad. Bad because the new rules will limit her sidewalk space. But good, she says, because with the permit, she won't be fined. Meanwhile, for taqueros, fruteros, and thousands of vendors that feed and clothe LA, a new day is here, even if they don't know it yet. Covering immigrant communities, I'm Eric Galindo.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. As we close out 2019, we've been revisiting some of the stories of the past year. Now, a few months ago, we talked to LA Times reporter Thomas Kerwin about one he's been working on, a series called The Street Within. For that story, he followed a group of homeless people living on the streets of South Los Angeles. They were part of a program called Encampment to Home. The way it worked, people were fast-tracked into apartments and then set up with services to help them become independent. Kerwin focused on two of them who secured places to live, Dion Hines and his friend Lanice or Nisi Pope.
Hey, Greg, what you doing?
Oh, I just got my keys.
That's where I'm at now.
I thought it was going to never happen. I was like, no, that's not going to happen, but it's here. I got it.
Now, she finally had a roof over her head, but there was no guarantee that Nisi would be able to keep it. Now, after 6 months, she was back living in a tent on the sidewalk.
I miss my apartment, though. I miss it. Man, I want to cry, but I'm not going to do it.
Today, we welcome back reporter Thomas Kerwin, who on Sunday published a follow-up to his series. He's in studio with us now. Thomas, welcome back.
Hey, thank you, eh?
All right, now, can you sum up some of the reasons why Nisi had to leave her apartment?
Well, when Nisi got into her apartment, she had a lot of visitors, and some of these visitors caused problems for other tenants in the building. Eventually, management saw that this was getting to be almost a dangerous kind of situation with some of the visitors that were knocking on her door. And after a number of warnings and counselings and attempts to encourage her to limit the number of the amount of traffic coming into her place, she just seemed to be unable to do that. And eventually the property management of the apartments decided it was time for her to leave, and she did.
Now, she relinquished the apartment, right?
Yeah, it's an important distinction. She relinquished it so she wouldn't have an eviction on her record.
Now, a few weeks ago, we talked with Peter Lynn. He's the departing head of the L.A. Homeless Services Authority. That's the city and county agency tasked with coordinating homeless efforts. His last day is actually today, and he left us with this takeaway.
There's only really one solution to homelessness, and that's housing. We need housing at all levels.
Right now, we're spending millions to build housing for the homeless. But is housing really enough? Problem solved.
I think that is what we all hope would be the case. But my reporting shows that it's a lot more complicated than that. But the whole idea of housing first is that once you get people into housing, you need to provide them with the services that are going to allow them to retain their housing. That's really the profound challenge that I think faces us all. Getting them to stay into housing is the challenge.
When it comes to Nisi, in your story, you say that Nisi represents just a small percentage of those who don't make it, can't keep their housing. What are city and county officials doing to try and help them as much as possible to stay in that dwelling?
So to take the Encampment to Home program, to be specific about that, 111 individuals were moved out of the area around Broadway Place and Leimert Park into these apartments at El Segundo Boulevard and the 110 freeway. When they moved in their apartment, they were given case managers who are on site in that building who are there helping them adjust, helping them build a community, helping them find jobs if they need. Nisi had a case manager who was there to help her as well, but sometimes the best efforts of those case managers aren't enough to help the individuals retain their housing.
Talking to Thomas Kerwin, LA Times reporter. His series is called The Streets Within. Now, you've been reporting out on this story for months. Have you been able to identify some habits that people pick up from living on the streets and what makes them so hard to break?
The habits that people bring from the street into the apartments there are many of them, not the least of which is just the community that they want to keep with them. So in Nisi's case, she invited a lot of friends over to her apartment, friends that she would see out on the street, friends that were just looking for a place to hang out. And the apartment proved to be a very sort of compatible place for them all to gather. And Nisi was more than happy to bring them in there. Of course, on the street, you just have a tent. And often you're sitting on a chair on the sidewalk next to your tent, and people are coming and going, and you're always seeing them, and you're always socializing with the people that are passing by, whether they're on bikes or walking on the sidewalk. It's that socialization on the street that creates a degree of community out there that in its own right is a form of strength for the people on the street. I think that when they get into apartments, that community gets broken in part, so it's more difficult for people to feel that sort of strength in a community in the apartments. On the street, they're living in squalor. It's really, really difficult circumstances. And yet somehow those circumstances are easier for them than being in an apartment. It's hard to imagine why that's the case, but I think if you get to the bottom of it, you understand that when you're on the street, there's really no way you can fail. You're already at the bottom. That's a degree of comfort, I believe, for the people that are on the street.
Now, given what you've observed, Thomas, how should officials maybe rethink their approach to homelessness and the kinds of services that are offered?
I think it's really important that we focus on the supportive aspect of housing. Without a supportive component, people will probably fall out again. They tell me that the numbers are pretty small. The percentage of people that fall out of housing is pretty small. But given the volume of people that are homeless in Los Angeles, even a small percentage is a lot. I really do feel that we need to redouble our efforts in providing a support for the people in these apartments, whether it's in counseling, whether it's getting them jobs, whether it's building communities inside these buildings that will sustain them in the same way that the communities on the street have sustained them.
How much of this, Thomas, you think falls back on us, people that look at this homelessness issue from afar, from a distance, and think, well, you know what, you can get out of homelessness, just pull yourself up from your bootstraps and figure it out?
I think that the greatest burden upon us is to develop our understanding of what actually is going on in this crisis. We drive by these tents, we drive by these encampments, and we think we know what's happening there, but I don't even know what's happening there. As I say, after the reporting of the last few months, I was confounded by the fact that Nisi and Dion remained on the street there despite the best efforts of outreach to get them into apartments. What was it that made the streets almost more appealing than getting into apartments? I don't know if I have a complete answer to that, but it requires all of us to really challenge our understanding of what the roots of homelessness are. It goes far deeper, in my opinion, and I think the reporting holds up, that it goes far deeper than just the absence of housing alone. And I think that for people looking at it from afar, the burden is on us to bring as much understanding and compassion to this predicament as we possibly can.
Do people like Nisi get second chances in L.A. to get off the streets?
Yeah. You know, Dion, I got an email from his case manager, and I'm assuming the same is happening with Nisi as well. But he, over the last few weeks, has gotten far more motivated to get into housing. His situation and Nisi's situation is more challenging because right now they're among the some 59,000 people out there looking for housing. That's going to be a challenge for him and for her to find a unit. But they're very motivated toward getting their vouchers and getting their paperwork organized and put in order so that they can go out and start looking for that apartment.
You've been close to this for a long time, and even you admit that sometimes it's hard to pinpoint exactly why all this happens. Where does all this leave you personally on your feelings about the homelessness crisis in LA and how and when it can be ever solved?
I go back and forth on that. On one day, I'm discouraged and I feel like this is a problem that's gotten away from us and is going to be a very, very difficult problem to resolve so long as our society is so polarized between opportunity and lack of opportunity. Other days, I have to believe that the promise of Los Angeles, this dream of a city, can actually figure out the solution. I have to say that latter thought is waning a little bit in my mind, though, as I see the size and the scope of this problem.
Thomas Kerwin, LA Times reporter. His series is called The Streets Within. Thomas, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, I'm A. Martinez. College football makes its way back to the Rose Bowl tomorrow, where Oregon and Wisconsin will go head-to-head. So ahead of the game, we thought we'd take a look back at the history of one team's mascot. That's the Oregon Duck, who has some pretty serious connections to Southern California. Zach Bigalke is here to fill us in. He's a contributing writer at the sports news site Saturday Blitz, and he's also a former research assistant for the University of Oregon's documenting UO History Project, where he focused on the school's sports history. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
All right, let's start by going back in time to the days before the mascot was officially recognized as the Oregon Duck. What or who was the mascot before then?
When the school first started playing football in 1894, they really had no mascot. They basically referred to the team as the Lemon Yellow based on the piping on their uniforms. They started being called the Webfoot or the Webfeet in Thanksgiving 1894 is the first time we really see that term applied to the team. And the funny thing is this term actually has nothing to do with a duck originally. So this is a pejorative that started in New England, somewhere around Massachusetts in the 1700s for locals who would live in wet conditions. That term kind of stuck with the team, and it's honestly sports writers trying to save a couple of typeface lines in their print who shortened it to ducks.
That's the reason. That's why it went from Webfoot to ducks?
Yep, that's exactly how it happened. The school didn't officially recognize this as their mascot in any capacity until the 1920s. So it's something that's happening just sort of out there in the public domain, but the university isn't officially attached to it in any way.
Well, how did people feel then, though, going from Webfoots to ducks? Because you mentioned how Webfoot was a pejorative, but eventually people kind of embraced it a little bit.
So it's funny. There in the 1920s, you had certain people at the school who really chose to embrace it. There was a fraternity on campus that would get a duck from the nearby mill race and bring it to football and basketball games. This is where the legend of Puddles the Duck originally started, was not the name for the mascot we know now, but actually the live duck that would come to games from the 1920s through the early 1940s until the Humane Society stepped in and said, hey, stop using wildlife for your mascot. But until that time, for like 20 years, campus security would have signs up basically saying, do not disturb the mascot ducks.
We're talking to Zach Bigalke. He is a contributing writer at Saturday Blitz, talking about the origins of the University of Oregon's duck mascot. Okay, so eventually they settled back to being the ducks. And I understand that Disney played a role in all this. What role did Walt Disney have in all this?
So through the 1920s through the 1940s, you see ducks continue to be applied by sports editors. Finally, the athletic director at the time, Leo Harris, he steps up and he finally says in the 1940s, hey, we need to find some kind of duck representation for the school. We need an actual, you know, caricature, an actual mascot to go with this moniker that we have. And he ends up making a handshake deal with Walt Disney in 1947, where the Disney company allows basically Oregon to use Donald Duck's likeness as long as it was used in what they said should be a reputable manner.
Reputable manner. What would that mean?
So obviously, you know, Disney had a say in how he was portrayed and where it could be used and where it was licensed. So this was a mascot that could be seen at the stadium and, you know, in the campus bookstore, but you would never see it on merchandise anywhere else. Basically, Disney retained the image likeness rights to this and also held a lot of sway in where the actual physical person in the mascot suit could go.
Now, that was a handshake deal with Walt Disney. When he died, what happened? Did the deal continue?
Walt Disney died in 1966. And in the preceding two decades, the studio had produced several versions of the Donald Duck mascot for the University of Oregon, collaborating with the school. And then he dies in 1966, and they realize there's no formal contract here. It had always been based on the handshake deal between Leo Harris and Walt Disney in 1947. And so for the next 7 years, the school and Disney end up hammering out a contract with each other about how the image can be used, how Donald can be used to represent the school. And of course, the school is, you know, still informally getting to use the imagery at the time. But it's really funny how it all just was trust between two individuals that set this in motion.
Now, Zach, I remember, I think it was back in 2006 or 2007, there was a big controversy because the Duck, the Oregon Duck, got into a fight with the University of Houston Cougar mascot. So it's a cougar and a duck fighting on the field. Did that have anything to do with maybe Disney deciding to disassociate themselves with Oregon's Duck?
You know, I never found any specific evidence about them using that as the impetus to separate themselves. It wasn't until 2010 that you actually saw Disney dissociate from the physical mascot. And it's interesting because they still maintain image rights over different representations of the Donald character and how it's used on merchandise and memorabilia, but they pretty much loosen the reins on the duck itself.
So it sounds like the duck mascot and its association with the University of Oregon has had a very long history. It's been loved. It's been unloved. Where does it stand now among students, staff, athletes, fans? I know that the University of Oregon's football team has thousands and thousands of combinations for their football uniforms, and some of it does have feathers and maybe not necessarily the old cartoon duck. But I mean, where do things stand now?
The university has always had its detractors for the duck, and specifically that Donald representation. I mean, as early as the 1970s, you saw both students and even coaches coming out and trying to realign the image of the university in a different way. At the same time, the Emerald, the campus newspaper, had another contest for creating a new duck image. So I think by that point, the idea of Oregon being the Ducks had pretty much stuck.
Zach Bigalke is a contributing writer at Saturday Blitz. He's been covering sports for various publications since 2006. Zach, thanks a lot.
Hey, it's such a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Before the big game kicks off, 20 bands will take to the streets in Pasadena to march in the world-famous Rose Parade. One of them comes from Moreno Valley in the Inland Empire. Band director Hong Lak Hatuk says they've been hard at work practicing, but also raising $150,000 through things like a 10K run.
It was a lot of money. It wasn't small for our school and our kids. So the kids worked really, really hard all year just to make sure they had everything they needed.
We caught up with those kids earlier this week at BandFest, an annual event at which bands marching in the parade perform at Pasadena City College.
We give you Rancho Verde High School.
This is the first time Rancho Verde's ever been in the Rose Parade, and the feeling is so amazing.
Hi, my name is Evelyn Barum. I'm a color guard member of the Rancho Verde Criticism Regiment, and I'm in 12th grade. I found out that I was going to the Rose Parade last year.
I'm so excited that you will be with us, be part of America's New Year celebration on January 1, 2020.
So on New Year's, I woke up early in the morning to watch the parade. And I remember telling my parents, like, oh, that's going to be me next year. And instead of going on like my breaks, my school breaks, I went to practice for the Rose Parade, and I don't regret it at all.
The only thing that's stopping our kids from being the greatest kids you could ever see is just the opportunity and the experiences that they should be able to have. And our school district and our kids work really, really hard so that things like socioeconomical issues don't affect our success. Over the season, we've put in about 700 to 800 hours of practice. Once Christmas came, we were at 8-hour days. We were marching the track for 3-4 miles at a time. It just makes me really happy that my kids can experience something so wonderful as the Rose Parade and walking down Colorado Boulevard. We'll be in uniform at 3:30, we'll be on the street by 4:30. And excited about the sun coming up on the band in the morning and our new life of our band starts on New Year's Day.
And that story was recorded by KPCC's Pablo Cabrera and produced by KPCC Arts Education reporter Carla Javier.
Good old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind.
I was thinking 2019 was a big change year for Take Two. We went from being a 9 a.m. show, a morning show, to a 2 o'clock show, an afternoon show. That was a big change for us, but I think it went really, really well, and we're really excited over what the new year is going to bring. So bring on 2020, and thanks for listening to Take Two.